Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Litecoin Underground podcast. This one, real quick, is just the second part of the Vlad Kostya interview. If you haven't gone and listened to that one, it's an interesting discussion with him as always. And this is kind of leading into, he starts talking a little bit about maybe some of the frustrations or doubts he has about the continuation of Bitcoin development. I don't think he thinks it's not happening. I think it's just he knows there's a lot more roadblocks than there are with some other places. So I don't want to drag this out too much. As you know, CakeWalt always sponsors every episode, and so I want to make sure I mention them. They're a great partner. If you're going to use a wallet, use CakeWalt. It really has all the functionality you would want. So have a good week. Take it easy, and thanks again for always listening.
Partially, but at the same time, what's happening right now with the miners is interesting, as you have these large companies from the US that on one hand, they're losing money right now. They're not running at a profitable threshold because they're not earning too much from fees. And the price didn't really go up according to expectations. I guess everyone after the ETFs, they were hoping for 100K at least. So they bought a lot of ASICs. They're still running them, but they're not making any profits. And I think with this administration, they also get taxed too much. And the only way in which they can still be profitable is to move somewhere else. And I don't think they want to move somewhere else. So I think in the next year or two, we're going to see the miners, unless there's a massive price increase, like 2 or 3x for Bitcoin, we're going to see miners become more vocal about their needs, because so far they have been very nice and obedient and cooperative and saying, you know, we're fine, we're making profits. But after this halving, it's become more brutal for them. And they do realize that this cannot go on forever.
They have more weight to push around too now. They've got more influence, they've got more money.
And I think mining is more decentralized than it was 7 years ago, when you could rightfully argue that much of it is happening in China. And some of the same companies that manufacture the ASIC miners are taking advantage from them. Now it's a lot more decentralized. Mm-hmm. Some will argue that it's not decentralized enough. And it's funny because you get developers saying that Foundry, which is the largest mining pool right now, is an existential threat to Bitcoin, because it's backed by an American company and there are no outside participants. It's not a pool in the sense that you have different users who are joining to mine with them. It's just one monolithic company that's doing everything.
Solo mining.
It's essentially solo mining, yeah.
So, because here's something that we talked about this, because that Marathon, you know, I think it was like their board of directors, and the guy who is the head of their board of directors said something along the lines of, you know, Bitcoin mining is a matter of national security, which as soon as those words came out, I'm going, okay, they're eventually going to be looking for some reason to justify state involvement. Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Subsidizing, protecting their, maybe cutting their costs, giving them cheap access to electricity, but essentially putting them in a position that they'll outcompete someone who doesn't have access to the federal government. Right. So in exchange, the federal government's not going to do this just for fun, right? They're going to expect something out of it, which is likely censorship. And almost to the point of, I imagine they'll maybe only mine blocks that from certain entities. It could even get to that point, right? What I don't understand from a technical perspective, you can tell me, what is the obsession with number go up in hash rate? Because it ultimately doesn't really, the number itself doesn't change a whole lot, right?
No, especially in an environment where you have mining pools, it doesn't change too much. But it does prove that there are more of these devices that go online. So I think...
Ooh, I could show you some math that maybe that's not true.
The hash rate is an indicator of faith in the network's success, I think.
But hash rate's gone up a lot because of the machines are more efficient than they were. It doesn't mean more unique individuals are necessarily mining. It's just the machines themselves are like 100 times more powerful than they were 8 years ago.
It also means that the miners believe in the network enough to upgrade their gears and stay competitive. It proves that there's genuine interest. There is demand for becoming more efficient, for buying the latest ASICs, for running them. Because if they were not, if they got cold feet about Bitcoin, they would just switch off and sell off all of their ASICs to another company. And we would have these drops in hash rate for a few weeks. But we haven't really experienced that. Even when China supposedly kicked out most of the miners and the companies moved to other countries, we still didn't have that dramatic drop that everyone expected.
But I mean, we did see a, was it 20% drop around that time? For like a month?
It was 3 years ago.
Yeah, it was like, it was for about a month or two before they moved to, I don't know, Kazakhstan or something, right? Like, where again, like they were, I think they were mining with coal. I'm just curious because I have some friends that are critical, really critical of Bitcoin, anything proof of work. They're huge Solana and Ethereum fans. I'm just curious what you say to the critics saying that proof of work is just an environmental catastrophe. It's bad for the environment that it's, you know, there's no point. Like, what's the point of proof of work when you have proof of stake?
Oh, so is their existence, but I digress. My point right now is that proof of work is the only fair way to distribute the coins, at least initially. It's the only way in which you have some actual cost to the generation of coins. If you want the currency to get produced, you don't just print it out of thin air with no cost and then make some scheme and distribute it to early investors and to devs and then sell it to retail. And the only way to acquire coins within a proof of stake environment is to buy them from someone. But in the case of proof of work, you can actually earn them by participating in the system. Of course, it's not economical always. It's not the best way, but it's an alternative that you have. If you don't want to pump someone's bags by purchasing the currency, you're just mining. You're investing in hardware and you're using electricity for the purpose of securing the network. So you're also contributing to it and you receive a reward randomly or by virtue of your chances, according to how much hash rate you have. So there is no fairer way to distribute the currency. If it's proof of stake, it just means that it's centralized. And there is no way for a proof of stake system, especially if it starts out of as proof of stake, to remain decentralized.
I mean, so, Ethereum almost had it, right? Like, but the problem with Ethereum, I guess, is that there was a huge pre-mine and Vitalik still owns a ton of it.
No, I think that's exactly why they could trust in proof of stake, that it could stay secure and not be outvoted. Because this is another attack vector in proof of stake. In proof of work, you cannot print more ASICs, right? They require some very specific materials and some knowledge on how to build them.
Some people can't print them. Some people can create them.
Okay, but you run out of resources at one point. Yeah, but in proof of stake, you just print money. You print money, you buy your stake in that network, and that's it. You can vote to do whatever you want. And it doesn't even have to be obvious. You can do it over time. You can do it from multiple entities, and then you rig the system.
Do you think like someone like Monero, who's gotten to their tail emission, the initial distribution is done, that a migration to proof of stake is worth considering?
No, because Monero has been very protective of the ability to mine with your CPU. Every time there was an ASIC made for Monero, they would hard fork into something that allowed you to mine with your CPU. And they're very adamant about it because they do want anyone around the world to be able to get their own coins privately and then send them to whoever they want.
Okay.
That's an important aspect of what Monero is by design. And I do admire them because even though they do have a degree of trust in developers and development in general, they do understand what the purpose of the project is. So they don't spread in multiple directions and try to test the market for something else like NFTs or whatever. They know that their purpose is just to fulfill this use case. So they optimize for it. which is beautiful. In the case of Bitcoin, you always have people fighting, saying, you know, it's also this. It's not just that. It's not just a money system. It's also a way for me to put tokens on it. It's also a way to build digital identity on it. It's also a way for me to express myself with up-return messages that I put just like Satoshi and stuff like this. In the case of Monero, there is no ambiguity about what it is. Everyone knows what it is and how you can use it, and they optimize around that use case. So I do admire them for this.
Yeah, I was kind of, I was really against Ethereum when they were doing the hat, like the GPU mining and stuff. I thought, especially because I'm a gamer, and made it pretty hard for a couple of years to get your hands on a decent GPU at a reasonable price. So when they went to proof of stake, I was pretty happy. Monero, like, I had thought about it the same way for a little bit, thinking like, you know, why not just use ASICs? Why not like not create a supply shock for AMD CPUs? But ultimately, I feel like there's less of a supply shock. You know, AMD CPUs are still competitively priced. Sorry. Shut up.
I think I'm talking to her.
I'm not. But I agree. Like, I really enjoy, I don't have any Monero. I think it's a cool project, but I can't.
Nobody has any Monero.
But, right, sure. But I also feel like it's just, I do like the script ecosystem. And I feel like it's ultimately going to be more successful.
Well, this is a little bit, because I know you want to tap into the script. I'm going to cut you off real quick.
Sure.
Because I think when you talk about miners looking for, I think they're looking for ways to make new revenue. And this new, maybe you can explain what this fractal Bitcoin is, but Animal, I think, was going to go into script and, you know.
I just want to say that, like, to start a financial revolution, right, which is what I think we're all trying to do here, right? Trying to debank everyone, I guess. You can't unbank really do that. Bank. Yeah, whatever. Like, unbank.
Unbank people, the banked. But that's what we should. That should be our new slogan. Instead of bank the unbanked, it's unbank the banked.
It's just what I want to say is it's hard to start a financial revolution from the shadows, right? And especially if everyone's who's a Monero, you know, everyone who has Monero never admits to it. Like, how are you going to gain traction, right? So yeah. Anyways. Yeah,
I think this is their time to shine. There was never another time in history that demanded so much privacy for the average internet user. There was never another moment when you were so surveilled by corporations and governments and all the people you don't want to have your data. So I do think that in some ways these privacy coins were ahead of their time when they got launched. They were made by these activists who are concerned about stuff that was not really happening. But now it's really happening. All of the concerns that they had are real right now.
Mm-hmm.
You could see you're from Canada. I'm not sure how close you are to the protests that happened 2 years ago in Ottawa. Truckers. Yeah, the truckers. But they did have this initiative to give them Bitcoin. And I did hear that it was pretty much a failure
in the everyone's sense that Coinbase accounts got everyone's Coinbase accounts got canceled or whatever. They had a Kickstarter, like, what was the Bitcoin equivalent of a Kickstarter, that, you know, basically everyone got doxxed. Everyone that donated was doxxed and debanked unwillfully.
Did it in the wrong way, because they told those guys, yeah, go open a Coinbase account rather than, hey, sponsor of our show, Cake Wallet, go download a mobile wallet like Cake Wallet, and you can receive without having to go through a third party. I mean, that's the whole purpose, right? And even beyond that, using something on there like MWeb, which we can talk about, or VPM, as we're trying to call it, right? That you can post an address and no one can see what's in your wallet. No one can track what you do with it after the fact. Like, those are those were the critical elements they missed. They just, again, and this is a little bit like the information void that's been created, is that everyone's just told, oh, this is perfect, uncensorable money. You can't F with it. You can account for it. And it's like, yeah, if you use it in a particular way, but if you're still, if you're using Strike, you can't send it to certain parts of the world, right? If you're using Coinbase, they can cut Alex Jones out, or they can take your money and freeze it if the state tells them to do that, because you're in some sort of litigation. Like that's not uneffable money. And that's probably the worst part of, I think I made a post about this recently about why I am hard on Bitcoiners. Granted, because I'm a Litecoiner and they have never been really nice to us, at least not in the last 4 or 5 years. And it's the misrepresentation of reality, I think, is what's so it's detrimental to the space, because people come in, they're lied to, and they go, oh, this is all just bullshit. Like that, you know, it didn't hit $100,000 4 years ago. Why would I believe it's going to happen again? Right. It's just, it's been a bad look for the entire space. And I don't know. I feel like the speculative nature of it has to be kind of killed before we can move on. You know, Lightning Network has been pretty effectively debunked as far as a viable long-term solution. You may not agree with me, Vlad, but for the most part, in its current state, no one is a believer that this is going to be what they were told. And so we're still see people pump it. They still won't let it die, but it's pretty much dying among people who understand what's going on. And I think the same will come true for the price speculation. Eventually people go, you know what? That can't be the only message we deliver. That can't be the sales trick, because it's not coming true.
Well, yeah, about the Lightning Network, it was actually Litecoin that used that first on the mainnet.
And hey, don't blame us for your problems.
There's no redemption arc for Litecoin within the toxic maximalist community. People overlook these facts and they say, no, it's not true. You're lying, blah, 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 even though it happened. And it's very sad right now, because I remember we did this panel 2 months ago in Nashville about the Lightning Network. And yeah, since then, you had two major events, which actually happened this week. There was Nayuta. It's a Japanese Lightning client. They were the fourth large team working on Lightning. The biggest one was, or it is, Lightning Labs. The other one is Blockstream with C Lightning, which they rebranded as Core Lightning. And then there is Phoenix, and their implementation is Eclair. So these three big ones got competition from another one from Japan that was trying to put Lightning Network on a Raspberry Pi Zero. So basically optimized for very low powered devices, also working on mobile wallets and phones. They have a pretty good mobile wallet, and they're shutting down their operations because they realize that the future of Lightning is custodial. And also the CEO says he has some health problems. So that might also be part of the reason. But one of the large four companies, and there are actually five right now, because there's also Jack Dorsey's toy with LDK, Lightning Development Kit. So one of these five got shut down, and it was also the weakest and the one that had the lowest amount of adoption, but it was an ambitious one which did not want to compromise with custodianship. And in the message that they posted as a way of saying goodbye, they said that they observed how Lightning is evolving past their goal of maintaining sovereignty and self-custody without compromise. And right now, custodial solutions are the one that actually have market success within the Lightning ecosystem. So it's sad. To me, this is a major failure for the Lightning Network. And I was thinking before this interview, actually, that I was able to see the entire cycle, the entire arc of Lightning from the beginning, how it was presented, that it's this solution to scale Bitcoin. It's not a solution, it's the solution. The only one solution that can actually scale a blockchain. And in the beginning, when Litecoin was involved, and there was some interest from the Monero side, they were trying to present this as a highway, right? Something where you put your coins and then you do atomic swaps, and it's going to make exchanges obsolete. It's going to enable this peer-to-peer economy to flourish. Then they dropped this whole angle and they decided it's Bitcoin only and it's Bitcoin only technology. And they got the early evangelists and they got the enthusiastic users like myself who were very excited to try new stuff and try UXs. And then they got more developers. They raised a lot of funding. I remember like 2 or 3 years ago, there was this guy, Brad Mills, and he is one of the biggest VCs in Lightning. Mm-hmm. That he was confused that when he received a payment that exceeded the capacity of his channels, he actually received part of the payment because part of the money went into opening the channel and he was confused about why that happens. Well, that's the architecture of Lightning. If someone is sending you more money than you actually have in liquidity, then he's going to open a channel and you're going to receive less money. And there are all of these moments when people realize that it's not really what it was advertised as. And the goalposts have moved constantly. It was supposed to be this new technology that enables seamless payments and easy UX and faster than Visa. And it's going to make all the altcoins obsolete when in fact it just helped Litecoin indirectly. Mm-hmm. Because people realize that it's not reliable. And of course it's not reliable because the topography of this network relies on nodes being online all the time. And it's unrealistic to assume that users are going to be able to maintain these routing nodes and keep them at full capacity, especially since they don't want to get doxxed for running nodes and they put them on top of Tor. So you're going to have slow payments. You're going to have a lot of failed payments. And then I think like 2 or 3 years ago, the narrative changed and they said, you know, it's nice that we tried to decentralize the network with these small home nodes, but it's time to get serious and only use professional infrastructure. So we're going to use LSPs, which stands for Lightning Service Providers, that allow you to open your own channels with them. And in exchange, you're giving up on this feature, important feature of sovereignty, which is running your own hardware. And I did switch to Phoenix and Breeze and Blix and all of these cool kid wallets that actually work pretty well. They have a much lower failure rate. But ironically, especially today, you realize that the on-chain fee for paying an on-chain transaction with Bitcoin is lower than what you pay with Phoenix Wallet, which is going to charge you like $1 or $2 for one transaction.
I don't even understand that. Kidding.
And they're basically an LSP.
And you know what's even crazier? None of these businesses is profitable. Yeah. They're not making the returns that everyone expected because Lightning is still small. It was never larger than 6,000 Bitcoin in terms of liquidity. It was just a bunch of enthusiastic adopters sending money between each other. And it got progressively smaller, and the number of companies working on it is also diminishing. And I think there was this reveal by a guy named Antoine Riard. I spoke with him briefly, and I invited him on my podcast, and he said he doesn't want to get the publicity for being the guy who destroyed the Lightning narrative, and he's actually looking for a fix for the stuff that he discovered. And he doesn't want to go public about it until he finds the fix. But the point is that Lightning has moved from being this grassroots movement with people running nodes to being centralized around infrastructure with LSPs to just giving up and saying, you know, custodial wallets are fine. Just use Wallet of Satoshi. And even that one fails. Like if you go to a store and you have your card. I don't have a card here. I just have this Pepe with Charlie that my girlfriend drew. Let's say that this is my card. And you tap this against the payment terminal. And you wait 10 seconds and you see that the payment failed. And then you use it again, maybe in a week, and it fails again. Are you going to use that payment system? Mm-hmm. You're going to feel embarrassed looking at all the people waiting in line behind you. And you're going to say, I'm just going to use something that works 100% of the time.
Right.
That's like a Bolt card you're talking about, right?
Bolt cards or pretty much anything Lightning. It doesn't matter if it's a card or if you scan a QR and you send. It is a bit embarrassing to wait for that confirmation. I mean, it's nice, it's Cypherpunk, but it's, I think it was misadvertised and misused in terms of what it can be. And right now there's this whole movement of people building eCash on top of Custodial Lightning. And they say, look, maybe that we were not able to do this in a decentralized way. Maybe that this custodian can censor you. But at the same time, how about we give you some privacy so that the custodian doesn't know it's actually you who's sending the transactions? Which is fine, I guess. It's fine for its use case, but it's not the scaling solution. It's not.
Is that, are you talking about Cashew?
Cashew, and there's the other one that's called Fediment.
Fediment
is trying to establish federations of eCash. And that's going to, in my opinion, that's going to lead to a lot of rug pulls with people stealing Bitcoin.
You know, you made me think about when you talked about, you know, there's fees on Lightning. And it made me think like the old phrase that your grandparents might say, there's no such thing as a free lunch, right? Somebody's going to have to pay this fee at some point. And that's always been my beef with Lightning is like, why do I, as the merchant, now I have to go pay the fee because you want to pay me in Bitcoin? So it's a penalty to me. That's kind of one of the benefits of me as a merchant. I don't have to pay a fee. But if I want to take my Lightning Bitcoin and move it on chain, then I'm paying the fee. Doesn't seem fair. So yeah, you're going to pay it through fees or inflation. If you want to secure the network, there's got to be, that fee has to be paid. And I feel like it's a very like communist utopia belief system that someone else is going to pay for it. Like that's what all this stuff seems to be. I like the security, but I don't want to pay for it. So go figure some way out that I don't have to pay for the fee. And that's what, they're sacrificing everything for, just because they don't want to pay fees. That's really the end of the day. If you love the network so much, pay the fee.
At the peak of the Lightning success, there was this guy. I remember his face. Rene Picard. That's his name. Mm-hmm. So Rene Picard was trying to create this initiative that's called through zero routing, which means he was setting the default fee to zero. And he was convincing a bunch of other people to do the same, to basically take a lot of the economic activity. When people are looking to send cheap payments, they're basically going to go through these nodes. And he was thinking about it in terms of, yeah, this communist utopia. And of course, it never worked. Of course, it's not around anymore because nobody wants to run their server 24/7 and pay maybe $100 every month to keep it online and then make no money off of it. That's not really how it works. As much as there is some kindness and benevolence in this world, you can't expect everyone to do this. But I think also Lightning was misadvertised, because for what it is, it could be used as this payment channel system, where instead of sending 10 transactions, let's say someone gets hired for a year or something to work for a company, and the company is going to pay the monthly salary to that employee. Maybe they can open a channel, and instead of having 12 payments, one every month, they're going to have this Lightning channel that they open between each other, and then they finally settle, and that's the end of it. So that could be a way to use it. But it was not advertised for its payment channel capacity, which implies that you're going to return to the base layer. It's still being advertised by some developers as the way to get off the blockchain and never touch it.
Mm-hmm.
And that can only work in a custodial environment, unfortunately.
Yeah.
At least so far.
Do you think... Because when we were in Nashville... some of us were talking about the possibility of perhaps using MWeb and Lightning, or putting Lightning on the extension block, on the MWeb extension block. How many of those problems do you think that would solve? You know, the privacy issue, liquidity management, the hub and spoke, or I guess the issues with having a hub and spoke topology kind of almost go away if you have perfect anonymity. Do you think that would ultimately be, I guess, Lightning's final form?
I guess, but it's a matter of survival, I think, at this point. The question is, for how long is Lightning going to be around and going to be presented as this revolutionary scaling technology? Because maybe something like rollups is going to become much more popular. ZK rollups right now are huge in Ethereum. There's a lot of money going into them. There are a bunch of teams in Bitcoin trying to bring that to Bitcoin. And so far, they were not able to do it in a trust minimized way, or not, just not good enough. But with stuff like BitVM, and that's something that gives me some hope in Bitcoin, the existence of these projects and protocols that get built by some guy, and he's just trying to create something for their own use case, and then people figure out something else that they can do with it, just like ordinals, right? That one was such a disruptive invention because it came out of nowhere. It tapped into an existing market. It was built without permission from anyone. And I think it was very powerful. And then people figured out that they can put much more than JPEGs in Bitcoin blocks. They can also put zero knowledge proofs that they can use for verifying certain stuff. So I think that's huge. It was something that's truly cypherpunk and something that I wish I would see more of, and something that I have on my podcast. And that's why I still think that Bitcoin can succeed. But it just seems that the adversary is so powerful and controls the narrative. And I'm also disappointed when I see in Litecoin that some people say, oh, maybe that we should get an ETF. Maybe that Grayscale should buy more of these coins. Maybe that we should have more institutional adoption. How does that solve any of the problem, any of the problems that Litecoin has? Because the purpose of Litecoin is to be the currency for payments. And if you're going to get the same sort of speculative adoption that happened in Bitcoin, maybe that Litecoin scale is better and people are going to be able to transact it for lower costs. But still, it doesn't increase adoption. And mm-hmm. Do you honestly think that more people will get into Litecoin if there's an ETF?
Probably less people will buy into it.
They'll invest, but they won't use it. Yeah.
No, just
I think the challenge for Litecoin is to get more users. And yeah. So far, it's been pretty successful, at least in the US. And I do see here in Europe that Litecoin is an option on pretty much every exchange or ATM, with few exceptions. There are the ones that say they're Bitcoin only, but aside from these, Litecoin is everywhere.
They probably have to manually disable Litecoin, right? Because it's probably enabled by default on their Bitcoin ATMs.
Yeah, Bitcoin, I say it all the time, because this happens over and over. These businesses go out of business that are Bitcoin only. It's a death sentence. And you can't survive. You're not going to be able to compete with somebody who's able to operate with 10 different chains, because humans are humans and they don't want to restrict themselves. Like, that's one of the biggest weaknesses of Light Wallet. I think it's a great wallet, but it's one asset. So it's just limiting. And if you want to use other chains for whatever reason, it's easier just to use something like CakeWell, where you've got them all in the same place. So yeah, just that siloed world just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't work. You don't go to a restaurant and they serve you one dish. They don't have a store that has one product. It just doesn't. Different strokes for different folks. You know what I'm saying? But we're already an hour and a half. Animal and I like to talk. It's one of our strengths, but also one of our weaknesses. And I have it more than him probably, but I do want to talk a little bit about I want to talk a little more into drive chains, because I do think this is something that we got hot and heavy on here when we had Paul on and we talked about it. It was debated as Litecoin community. What would be your concerns? Because I think as a person that has probably done the deep dive much more than me into the technical aspect of this, I see it as a very like free market option, in that the miners are going to need ways to attract users. Like you said, mm-hmm. fees are important. I do have a concern about if you're essentially infinitely growing block space by adding all these drive chains, fees will stay incredibly low to the point that it may actually be detrimental. Although also, the miners get to control who comes in and who doesn't, right? So, to me, do you think there's risk involved in these drive chains not being what they're sold as, being, I don't say rugged, but essentially becoming more of a pain in the ass than the user expected, and it's a negative look on the main chain? And is it better to just avoid the whole thing altogether? I guess give me the good, the bad, and the ugly of drive chains here. I'm pretty sold, but I don't know the technicals.
I think the good and the most important benefit for Bitcoin and Litecoin is not the increase in capacity, but it's the fact that you can get every use case integrated as a sidechain.
Okay.
And I did read, I forget the name of the creator of MWeb, and now I'm going to get slaughtered for this.
David Burkett.
He did write that when you have something that's general purpose and you make assumptions, you're not really optimizing for anything. So you're just assuming that Ethereum developers are going to want to build on Litecoin, but you're building for something that you don't know if it's going to take off. And I do get that point, but I do see some developers who will want to use this, because Ethereum has very high fees and maybe that L2s are not very convenient. And to some degree, a drive chain of it with Ethereum features is going to basically be more decentralized than the average L2, where there are some keys that were generated by the creators of the L2, and basically the L2 creators can rug everyone. With drive chains, it's more nuanced because you deal with hash power. You don't deal with politics or a company. So I think this is the most interesting use case, but the criticism is that you're not sure if the users will come or that the builders will come. You're opening up the gates for something and you're saying, we can do this now, but you're not sure if that will ever be the case.
Are we ready for it? Right? Is the world ready for drive chains? Ultimately.
I think it is, but you just have to advertise it properly and have a user base of people who are demanding this and they want to use this. If you're just shooting in the dark, maybe it's not the right moment or something.
Yeah, the use case.
By the way, the pseudonym is Tom Elvis Judasaur, creator of Mimblewimble.
He was talking about David Burkett, though.
Oh, you're talking about David Burkett? Okay, I was talking about the creator of Mimblewimble is Tom Elvis Judasaur.
Yeah, that's the French name of Lord Voldemort.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I never read Harry Potter. I never even seen a movie. So,
but yeah. This is why we decided, and you didn't like it, Vlad, but we're as a community, we're rallying behind VPM because it's a way more understandable for the general masses than talking about a Harry Potter spell.
I don't know. I like MWeb. And well, I do could, think that. You, a lot of people my age right. have read Harry Potter.
you can still call it that. This is just a soft fork. You can still use your own terminology. Whenever we start talking about this, people are like, no, it's got to be MWeb. It's like, listen, guys, nothing is changing. We're just changing what we call it. There's nothing. It's not like we're throwing MWeb out and replacing it with something else. So
it's an easier brand to sell, I think. Who was it? Was it Robbie was saying, it's like, you know, imagine you're at a bar talking to a girl, explaining to her MWeb and, the origin of the name is Mimblewimble and all this stuff. You'll see her being really unimpressed really quickly. whereas like a VPN, I mean, she probably already knows what a VPN is, and VPN is just one small leap.
But MWeb is just like NFT, right? What's an NFT? A non-fungible token. What the hell is that? What's fungibility? What does non-fungible mean? What's a token? But it's still caught on, right?
Yeah, and I feel like people still don't understand fungibility. I hear a lot of Bitcoiners, maybe not all of them are the best ones, but talking about how Bitcoin's fungible. Dude, no, it's not.
You just reminded me of my favorite Bitcoiner, Guacamole Zucchini. I'm going to call him this. But
I love that you call him that.
He argued for a long time that blockchain analysis is just social, and at the protocol level, Bitcoin is fungible. And it's just humans who agree that certain Bitcoins can be censored, and therefore humans who are for censorship are against Bitcoin. Anyway, he has this theory. And then he got on some exchange and he sent some Bitcoins that were coin joined, and they were blocked. And he was asking for a refund, and they said, that's not how it works. We're going to ask you to give us more information about what you're doing and where the coins come from and stuff like this. And he said, no, I refuse to work with you. You are infringing on the principles of the Bitcoin network. And I'm like, this company to which you applied for a service does not deal with the Bitcoin network. You know, they have a jurisdiction. They're from the real world. You have to mitigate the conflict between these two situations. And of course, they want to stay in business. They're not going to make you a huge favor by breaking the law just so you can get your Bitcoin back without complying. So the moment you sent the Bitcoins, you consented to their terms of use. But he's denying that. He's saying, oh, you're infringing on the principles of Bitcoin. And he made a big deal out of it. And he made himself look like this guy who's fighting for fungibility. But in reality, he just proved that he's a major idiot who has no idea what he's doing. And he's preaching to something or for something that is not practical. It's not how it works.
Yeah.
There's also the other side. There's John Carvalho, who is a big Bitcoin maximalist, and his idea of fungibility is just being able to withdraw from one exchange and get into the other without any issues. And he's anti-privacy for Bitcoin. He says it's just, or not anti-privacy, but anti-coin join. He says it's just not good enough.
He was the one that was on your show, and he was like saying how nobody cares about Litecoin, nobody uses it. And you're like, well, actually, a lot of people are using it. And he's like, what? Like, he was totally floored that Litecoin had any usage at all.
I'm not sure if it was John Carvalho, but definitely Peter Todd.
Peter Todd. Maybe it was Peter Todd, yeah.
Peter Todd said, yeah, nobody uses Litecoin. And I said, you know, it's number one on BitPay. And he said, oh, I got to question the statistics from BitPay. I don't trust them. John Carvalho used to work for BitRefill, so he's very much aware, first of all, that Charlie is an investor in that company. And secondly, that Litecoin always got a lot of action on BitRefill. There are a lot of customers using that service and paying with Litecoin. So I don't think he would make this sort of mistake.
Did you look at Matt Allberg's posts recently from BitRefill? Because we had him on last week, and it was a fairly long episode, like this one is too. But that was a really eye-opener talking him through that, because it really was, you look at it, it's stable. It's basically stable coins, Bitcoin and Litecoin, where the vast majority, maybe in Ethereum, I guess, would be on there just plain Ethereum. That was 80%. And Litecoin, I want to say, is maybe half of what Bitcoin is on there. And I don't know. I'm not someone to sit here and say Litecoin's going to flip Bitcoin, whatever that means. But in usage, I think Litecoin is absorbing users and growing consistently, because it can, right? Bitcoin's restricted. You can only have so many transactions on a day anyway. So at some point in time, Litecoin can just surpass them just because they have more block space. So that day will come. And I think having people who have built those habits of using it, like you said earlier, why would I go back? Like, what am I gaining by switching back to Bitcoin? And as people who are proponents and believers in something, Litecoin being the thing we believe in, we should be in that mindset all the time. I think that's a very healthy place to be, saying if Litecoin grows and fees go up, or it becomes too slow or more difficult to use in other chains, we should be thinking about how are we going to answer that and address it, rather than just digging your heels in and going, well, I don't have to change. They can change. They're the stupid ones. Like that's literally the marketing philosophy, is like everyone else is an idiot if they don't use Bitcoin. That's again, not how the real world works. That's not how businesses are run. you should be always thinking about who your consumers are and how do you service their need without, you don't want to sacrifice certain principles, of course, but you have to think adversarial thinking. Mm-hmm. So do you think people, what will bring people back? If you were a person who used Bitcoin and had a couple times or you ran into a $5 fee and you started using Litecoin, or maybe it's a stable coin instead of Bitcoin, what would be your pitch to somebody to say, this is why you should be using Bitcoin over what you're currently using?
Well, so far it's only been this performance against the US dollar, right? People said, look, during the bull market, Bitcoin is the first one to moon. Then a bunch of people sell their Bitcoin to pump their altcoins. And then they sell their altcoins. We enter bear markets. And during the bear market, Bitcoin is the one that loses the least of its evaluation against the US dollar. I think that has been the value proposition. You just buy and you hodl, right? And then you pay with your credit card. That's what people like Jimmy Song and Samson Mao are going to tell you. But that's not why.
Yeah,
that's not why Bitcoin was created. And a lot of people forget this, and it goes back to the rewriting of the narrative, because it seems like this has worked so far, and maybe it will keep on working for a while. But at one point, this price discovery and this expansion in terms of getting bigger and more important people to talk about Bitcoin and promote it, it's going to end at one point. I think at this point in time, everyone who has access to the internet or watched the news has heard about Bitcoin at least once. And I think the people who wanted to buy Bitcoin, they most likely already bought it. There's going to be some FOMO. There's going to be a generation of kids who are going to be old enough to have bank accounts and buy some Bitcoin. I'm not denying this. There's going to be another pump with retail money. I'm not questioning this. But how far can you go? So I think every cycle had its wave of celebrities and important people promoting Bitcoin. Back in 2013, you had all the celebrities from among the libertarian camp. And you also had a lot of adoption on Expedia and Steam and Microsoft Store. And it was just this initiative to onboard as many companies as possible. And then they hit the first major bear market. And during that bear market, they had this rewriting of the narrative. They were trying to say, okay, maybe that Bitcoin is not what we expected it to be, but we still have this blockchain thing, right? And we can put stable coins on it. We can put whatever. And then you had the entire blockchain, not Bitcoin narrative in 2017 and 2018. With lots of ICOs and altcoins emerging. And of course, most of them failed because they had bad underlying ideas, or the founders just wanted to get rich. But after this, you had a re-rationalization of the space. You had the block size wars, you had a major fork, and people tried to explain once again what Bitcoin is and what it's useful for. And they went back to the digital gold narrative, but they also said, we're going to have the Lightning Network, which is going to be the most important way to scale. Of course, we're also going to have sidechains, but instead of the sidechain, we got Liquid, which is a federation. And I'm happy that Blockstream got punished for it, because they half-assed their own invention, and they gave up on trying to create a sidechain. They just made the federation of large exchanges that basically are the gatekeepers of the system, and they never went anywhere, and they moved their goalposts all the time. At first, they wanted to be the scaling layer for Bitcoin when the fees get high. Then they said, this is just for exchanges to basically transact without triggering these whale bots. And then they realized that the exchanges actually enjoy triggering whale bots, because that's how they manipulate prices. And people generate a lot of noise and speculation whenever that happens, and they make money off of it. And then they said, we can make tokens, and we could always make tokens. So what if we tokenize Wall Street? Or what if we make a partnership with the government of El Salvador to put bonds from volcano mining on our sidechain? So that's how it kept narrowing its scope, but it's still not getting traction. At one point, it even had its own NFT marketplace, and that one never really caught on. And I know it because I was using it. It was called Rare Toshi.
I remember that.
I did use that. I did have some fun with it, but it never caught on because basically it was always behind Ethereum, and Ethereum was building something and they were trying to bring that on Liquid under the pretense that you're using BTC, the currency, and you also have some confidentiality for your transactions, but the market didn't care. It did not move the needle. You just had maybe 50, 100 new users who got excited and brought some more users, but nobody cared for it. And it goes back to the narrative for Bitcoin, right? Because we always try to re-explain it and redefine it according to what's happening. And I think the most major pivotal point in recent history was when Michael Saylor came around and said, you know, I'm just going to buy a lot of it. And you forget about your cypherpunk roots. You forget about wanting this to be private. You forget about even cheap transactions on second layers. Who cares about that?
Yeah.
Maybe that there is some Saylor interview where he says something nice about the Lightning Network, but I'm pretty sure that he never cared for that.
No, I think you're pushing.
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I think your push for privacy is extremely important. I think I know Naomi Brockwell is also pushing for it. She always has been, but like, you know, as you said earlier, like the time is right. I feel like people are primed more than ever to take their privacy seriously, to divorce themselves from centralized networks like Facebook, right? And I think that's something that Bitcoiners need to hear too. They need to realize that, you know, Lightning isn't super private, right? At least it could be private for the sender, but the receiver is almost never private. And yeah, like if you look at El Salvador and their success with Chivo, right? Well, they pretty much imposed it on their populace.
Was that a success?
I mean, it depends how you look at it. Like I have a theory that like their whole, you know, gang cleanup wouldn't have been made possible without the Chivo wallet. I feel like the timing is very coincidental. How they released Chivo with a $30 incentive to download and spend like a few or maybe 6 months prior to them starting to incarcerate like how much of the population, like 2% or something of the population. I feel like, yeah, the way they did it, pretty like, I don't know how actually, I heard it was pretty nonviolent. Like they would go into camps at night while they were sleeping. Like, how do they know everyone was asleep? Like, how did they know this is where they were all hanging out? I feel like it's very possible, and I hope, you know, it doesn't get me in trouble with any three-letter agencies, but I feel like it's possible they, you know, they put a Trojan on that Chivo wallet and it allowed them to listen to everyone, or at least to see where the money was going, right? Like if someone got $30 and they were like, yeah, you know, spend it wherever. First thing, you know, maybe a drug addict would do is go to their dealer. And so immediately you have like, you know, a dusting of all the whole network, the whole drug network, right? From this one app. We're going to make it extremely simple for the government to just go and clean it up, you know, sweep up all the drug dealers.
That is interesting timing. You're right. Well, and I do kind of want to wrap this up so we don't get too long. Although I give you an idea of the numbers here, guys. I don't know if you can see. We have 650 people watching, 652, 649 are on Twitter, and 3 are on YouTube. So I think we've settled the conversation of like, where should we be putting our content? Although it probably has a lot to do with Vlad's followers. But yeah, the privacy thing, what really struck me with Robbie's interview, Robbie Coleman, in our discussion about renaming MWeb to VPM, or referring to as VPM, we'll call it like a rebranding or whatever you want to call it. As he said that there's 1.8 billion users of VPNs today. And so when I think about it from terms of reaching out and communicating with people that they understand privacy being valuable in terms of you know, maybe what you're browsing on the internet, that they don't want their devices listening to them, that they don't want to be arrested for posting something on Facebook. You know, they see this, they don't want to be shut down like in Brazil for their X account. So that message rings much truer to a broader audience than digital gold. Like, there's not a lot of gold investors. People, when you start to talk about here's how you win, you can gain money, it starts to feel like a sales pitch to them, right? Like, oh, you can invest in real estate or whatever other scammy thing that's ever come across the internet, multi-level marketing. If you're just like, just buy this thing, it'll go up, you're going to get rich. People they start going, well, why? Like, you know, they just feel like it's a scam, even if it isn't a scam, right? And I think the privacy thing speaks to somebody on a level of, I'm actually trying to, here's something that can provide value to you beyond just, you're going to get rich. Like, this is a very mm-hmm. real thing. You understand VPNs, you understand why privacy is important. So here's this tool you can use that actually benefits you and not just pumps my bags.
Like, that's can ultimately actually be cool if you can make some integrations with these VPNs and have a VPM button where basically you're able to purchase some coins directly in your Mimblewimble address. Mm-hmm. And then you can spend these coins online. The problem is you hit the bottleneck of merchant adoption.
They don't have to. This is the trick of MWeb. That if BitRefill has an LTC address, I can send my VPM coins to BitRefill.
Mm-hmm.
Because I peg out on my side. So they receive on-chain Litecoin. They're none the wiser.
And if it goes over a certain amount, they'll probably ask you to, justify a KYC, right? Like, but if it's under $1,000, probably no issue.
But yeah, that's a perfect example. I know it's what Robbie, I don't remember what he talked. I think he talked about that's something they'd like to do is get something going with a VPN where it translates so easily. And people, like I said, my 11-year-old daughter, she knows what a VPN is because she watches YouTube and all the creators talk about, you know, half of them, that's one of the things they advertise is a VPN. Like when she was 8, I remember she came downstairs and she was like, we got to get a VPN. We got to get NordVPN. I'm like, what do you care about NordVPN? You're 8 years old. But she just been told, like, so many creators talked about it that she thought it was something you had to have, right? Like, that just shows you how powerful the repetition in the advertising is, that someone that she doesn't even understand the benefit of it, but she just believes that it's something we should have because it's so critical. So, I appreciate what you're doing for privacy. This is the original one. This one's signed by Charlie.
That's the July edition. This is the August edition.
Okay, so the August edition has, what's the change in it?
Well, one that you noticed immediately is that
the L.
You have an L on the shoulder of this muscle guy.
Yep. Oh, man. Yep.
And it also says August at the bottom. And there are some typos that were fixed. And there's something which was completed. For example, one of the mining pools was added because previously it was not in the article dedicated to which mining pool you should use. I think I've also corrected some stuff from this article about choosing your best wallet, because in the version that you have, the green ticks were showing as empty white boxes for some reason.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I see that.
So I fixed that. You can find this on GitHub. I made a repository for it. You can download this for free. Go to bitcoin-takeover.com/litecoin and you're going to be able to get the free PDF. But if you want to get the files that allow you to create your own copy with cover and every page, you go to github.com. I think it's /VladyC/Litecoin something. Just search for Litecoin magazine and you're going to find this. I'm not aware of any magazines about Litecoin being published right now. When I was, so I didn't mention this, it was a long interview, but back in 2018, I was a volunteer for the Litecoin Foundation, and also wrote the first 5 or 6 newsletter articles for the Litecoin Foundation. And there was a magazine that was only published online that was called Lite Life, LiteLife. And I published an article in every issue of that one. You can still find on Twitter the account. It had this silver bull on the cover. It was pretty cool. Okay. But I did write for that one. And I've been with the Litecoin community for a while. So I was interested in this. And then I became once again interested in it after you added MWeb. I think that's so groundbreaking. And even if you don't call it MWeb anymore, that's what I'm going to call it. I think
that's all right.
It's a cooler name.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere for sure.
I think it'll be a mark. It's a mark between whether you were here pre-2024 or not, right? If you call it MWeb, you were a Litecoin OG.
No, you're
not. Yeah, no, I mean, it's been great.
If you bought it below $10, but
yeah, I mean, it's been great to watch, you know, to see that you're open to this stuff. And, you know, as Litecoiners, we obviously feel starved for attention sometimes. And it's like, we just sit here and think, what? I don't understand what all the vitriol's for. You know, this is a perfectly usable tool all over the world. So why the hate? But, you know, we're in that environment. And I think your willingness to say, like, hey, there's use for these other things, whether it's Zcash or Monero, or I think you even have Xano on there, which maybe Xano. So I just think that's cool, and I appreciate what you're doing. So check out.
So short story, Adam Back told me that I don't know what I want when I say Bitcoin should have privacy, and I'm going to lose a lot of money if I go into privacy coins. And I told him, you know, F you, Adam Back. I'm going to create this index approach to investing in privacy coins, and I'm going to outperform Bitcoin.
All roads in Bitcoin lead to F you, Adam Back, right?
I don't know about that. It's just that he had this condescending parental attitude that I hate. It's when someone acts like that, like, I know better, just stand down and forget about it. Mm-hmm. Sit down, not stand down. Sit down and forget it. And I was like, you know, I'm stubborn.
Yeah.
I can do stuff and I can prove to you that you're wrong. And so far, I think I outperformed Bitcoin by like 60, 70% over the last 7 weeks.
That's funny.
And people say, oh, just lower your time preference, blah, blah, blah. On the long term, it's all going to zero against BTC. And I'm saying, let's see about this, because I'm not aware of any other time in history when privacy was so necessary. It's not just a luxury. It's not just something to show off and say, look at me, I transact with privacy. It's something that people actually need right now. And by virtue of my status of a privileged white man who's living in a European country, I'm investing in privacy. And I'm speculating that in the future, there's going to be a lot more demand for it. So thank you very much, woke people.
Yeah,
that's true.
No, and thank you, Vlad, because honestly, like, it feels sometimes like I'm taking crazy pills, you know, and having someone like you come to, I guess, voice similar opinions and defend, I guess, us against the maxis.
No, I'm a maxi. They're not. They're conservatives.
You're irrational. I want to say you're rational, Maxi.
No, I'm the original type of Maxi, which was all about improving Bitcoin. If there is anything interesting, you bring it to Bitcoin after you experiment with it on altcoins. That's what I believe in still.
Okay.
Right. How long but do you give it? Like, let's say you love MWeb, you think it's great, and everything about it, it's worked for 5 years on Litecoin. You go, there's zero reason for us not to do this. Like, why wouldn't we? Like, how long do you wait before you're like, you know what, I just give up?
I did interview Andrew Polstra on my show, and he's the creator of MWeb. He came up with this idea 6 or 7 years ago. And I asked him, what do you think about this? And he said, oh, it's nice that these Litecoin people have built it, but I think right now Bitcoin is heading towards a post-Taproot world with TapScript and OpCAD and stuff like this. And I'm like, okay, he gave up. He's not interested in this anymore. And someone asked me, I don't recall exactly who, but they told me, oh, since you had Andrew Polster on your show, can you invite him to the Litecoin Summit? And he said he's not interested or he's busy or something. But the point is that the guy who came up with the concept of putting Mimblewimble on a Bitcoin extension block basically gave up on it. And it's beautiful that Litecoin picked it up as opposed to something else which was easier to use and had more tooling. You built something very beautiful. And I know it took a long time and it was not easy. And by the time it was built, I think the initial hype was over. I was one of the people who reported that Litecoin is going to get confidential transactions back in 2018. And I remember very well that day because it was important for me. And I also created the thumbnail and everything else for the article. I was working for Crypto Insider. And I was very excited for this to happen. It did not happen until 4 years later, at least not on the mainnet, but I did follow the development. I was part of that torch that people passed around. And I still believe that it's pretty good. It's not Monero level, it's not Zcash level, but for something that's only a soft fork that gets added on top, it gives you privacy and it gives you extra scalability.
And it can walk in both worlds, right? It can walk in the corporate world, the light, and it can go into the dark in the privacy world. And I think that's, for me, one of its greatest assets.
There's nothing dark about privacy, trust me.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to contrast the two, I guess, in a simple way. But yeah, like in a house, would you put it in the corporate world and a private world?
Yeah,
it's
the way they built it. It did take a while, but the way it came out, I think, is great. I actually had something this week. There was somebody on Twitter, and they were asking for like a donation. It was a Dogecoiner, and I just kind of curious how much money have they received, and that basic functionality of I can go take this address and just go see what their ins and outs have been. That's to me where we're so far. By being able to just post an MWeb address and not have to worry about that, I think is huge. To me, that's the number one gain, in my opinion, is not having to advertise what's been received to an address. I just think that's such a blatant problem.
There's also cool. So let me plug your sponsor, Cake Wallet. They built silent payments for Bitcoin, and there's no reason to not bring that into Litecoin. Basically, it means that you can have this static address that generates a different address each time you send to it. And people watching from the outside, they cannot tell how many transactions you received and how much money you have. It's just people sending you money. They can track it on the public blockchain. But it's a pretty nice way to hide from just lurkers.
Yeah.
So one address that you can publish.
Yeah.
That automatically generates, I guess, different wallets or
different addresses every different time addresses. You send to it.
Right. In the same wallet. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, guys. I got to actually go pick up my daughter. So I got to go. But 700 people. This is pretty good. We're going to have to do this again, Animal. And thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, Vlad. Yeah. You should come buy more often.
The Vlad.
Also, get a Pepe by my girlfriend.
Oh, I am going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. You're the only one from.
Does she want to take
the more active Litecoin participants who don't have a Pepe yet? Charlie has one.
Let me think.
Animal has one. The lion guy has one. There are a bunch.
Think
of
how
them.
I want to look. How do I want to look in it? I could be up for it.
The way you look in this episode, I guess.
Yeah, she could try that if she wants. Got the guitar
microphone
back there and the mic, like up here maybe. And I'm like screaming or something. She can do whatever she wants with it. She could use, I got a gap in the tooth. She could like caricature that, you know?
No, the Pepe has his own lips.
Oh, does he? He doesn't have teeth? All right.
No teeth, no nose.
Oh, that's good for me. I got a big nose. All right. Well, hey, guys, thanks again. I'll get this put up somewhere. But yeah, it was a great conversation, Vlad. And maybe we'll try to maybe have you back in a few months or something once we can talk about patents and stuff like that or something. All right. All right, I'm going to end it here.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having me.